We're the least populated state in the union. Just a small change in the demographics here could upset the Wyoming economy, the Wyoming culture.
From Wyoming Public Media, this is The Modern West. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Under the new Trump administration, many immigrants and refugees are wondering what their place is in the U.S. As Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Huntington reports, educators in Jackson are helping their large number of Mexican students cope with emotions they may be encountering at home.
And we have to determine what's important. Was my wig really important?
No.
So do I think if I used my Earth and Space book that every single thing in that Earth and Space book should go in my report?
No.
Probably not, right? What about...
Thomas Ralston is teaching third graders at Jackson's Coulter Elementary. He teaches in the dual language immersion program, where half the children speak Spanish at home and the other half English. The students alternate learning in both languages. He says when children start talking politics, they're often mirroring their parents.
There was a lot of uneasiness. I think just a basic reflection of what you see around the country. Not necessarily because of who won or who lost, but when you have a large minority group making up half of your classroom in an election like this, there was obviously a lot of fear. There's a lot of worst case scenarios and end of the world type feelings.
The fear was that some of them may be forced to leave due to Donald Trump's tough talk on immigration. Coulter Elementary serves almost 600 students, and about 37% of those students are Latino. Principal Bo Miller says that immediately after the election, some did break down, worried about what changes in immigration policy might mean for their families.
One example is a child told their third grade teacher that they wouldn't be back after the weekend. And the teacher said, well, where are you going to go? And the child said, well, I'm sure we have to move back to Mexico. Mm-hmm. You know, speaking with this childlike innocence. And of course, the family was back on Monday, and we haven't seen a drop in enrollment.
Teacher Thomas Ralston says he's been dealing with his students' concerns by trying to teach them how government works.
We gave a really off-the-wall example, like the president wants to change all lunches to chocolate chip cookies every day. The president doesn't have the power to go in and do that. We talked about the three branches of government and how the checks and balances work and things like that.
Ralston says coping with political uncertainty isn't unique to Jackson.
I think you see the same uneasiness here that you would probably see in places like Gillette with natural gas and coal. You know, when it looked like it was going to be a predominantly Democratic election and those things were going to be shut down. I think there was a lot of those conversations that had to do with, you know, home finance and am I going to have a job and is now the time to get out of here, just like you're having here because the election went the other way.
Andy says kids are modeling how their parents cope with those uncertainties. He suggests that parents watch what they say around their children.
Just be a positive role model and be supportive of your kids. And if your kids ask questions, talk to them about it, just like anything else.
School counselor Charlotte DePrisco agrees.
Kids talk to each other, and I think that was what was kind of happening too, is that they would say, well, my parents said this, and then another kid would say, I didn't know that, now I'm really worried.
DePrisco says she talks through those concerns with children when parents or teachers ask her to help, so kids can calm their fears and get back to learning. Overall, Principal Bo Miller says things have calmed down, and he doesn't see visible signs of stress among students. More than anything, he says, he's witnessed an outpouring of support.
I think many people have heard about incidents in K-12 schools across the nation where there's some bullying harassment towards minorities, let's say Muslim populations. We're decidedly not seeing that. We're seeing support among our Anglo families for our Latinos. You know, they're a concern by them for our community.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Huntington in Jackson.
A federal refugee resettlement program vets refugees applying for asylum in the U.S. It helps them find jobs and learn English. Wyoming is the only state without this program, but that doesn't mean there aren't former refugees living in Wyoming. Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard brings us the story of Bertin Baige, who is trying to change things in Wyoming. He's a math teacher who lives in Gillette, but he was born in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
I always thought that I had, you know, my life completely, you know, drawn up. I have all these dreams, and I can see them happening until when the war started. And in the blink of an eye, changed everything.
The war was spillover from the civil war in Rwanda that broke out a couple years earlier. Rebel groups started patrolling the east, where Baij lived, looking for child soldiers.
I remember that day how bullet was flying, you know, bullet was flying. And we always hide under the bed. And, you know, you can hear the boots because all the soldiers wear plastic boots. Getting in house from house and, you know, knocking the door down and pulling people out. And I was pulled out there and, you know, thrown in a truck. And my mom was trying to protect me, and they just shoved her on the side and thrown in the truck and was taken away. I spent 2.5 years under the captivity, and I was able to escape and made my way all the way to Mozambique, where I was a refugee for 5 years.
Then Baij was selected through a refugee resettlement program to come to the U.S. He was brought to Maryland, where the NGOs and government agencies that were part of the program found him an apartment and helped him adjust to life in the U.S.
For example, showing you how a shower faucet works and how water, cold water, orientation, you go to classes at the office, how do you look for a job, they help you fill up application. After being in the country about 3-4 weeks, I was able to get a job at a Burger King in Maryland. That was my first job. And I couldn't speak the language, so I had to work in the back, cleaning and, you know, taking trash out. And, you know, a few months later, after attending English classes, they moved me from cleaning to actually reading the information from the screen and, you know, making burgers. And then a few months later to actually going up front and taking orders. That just made me feel like I was winning a lottery all over again. And then from that point, going all the way and working to the drive-thru. Those basics, it's the key that, you know, can help those refugees become successful, because once they are given those tools at the beginning and show them that the sky's the limit, the sky is truly the limit.
After living in Maryland, Baij was offered a scholarship to study math and education at the University of Wyoming. He moved to Laramie, graduated, and got married.
I never talked about my story. I never talked about my experiences. And the reason behind that was not that because I was ashamed about it, but I did not want people to feel sorry for me. I wanted people to look at me as a hardworking member of my community that is willing to do whatever it takes, you know, to be the best teacher that he can be. He can be a professional. That's what I wanted to portray.
But when Baij became a naturalized U.S. citizen, a reporter was at the ceremony. When he found out Baij's background, he asked to do a story.
As I was reflecting about it, and I was like, you know, if this can inspire somebody out there, if this can, you know, get somebody to realize that, you know, your worst day might not be the worst day. And, you know, there is always, always a brighter day if you can just stick to it. You know, I agreed to sit down with him, and he wrote a really amazing article.
After the article came out, Baij began to speak more about bringing a refugee resettlement program like the kind that helped him to Wyoming. He did more interviews and even spoke with the governor. But not everyone was happy about it, and the backlash started to get personal.
You know, our faces were everywhere. There were times where people were saying, oh, we know who you are, we, you know, we're going to do everything to stop you. And I'm sitting and I'm like, stop me for doing what? You know, this is nothing but a discussion. People took it as if there were going to be a tent city in Wyoming. So there was a lot of misconstrued information that was there. I struggled a lot with that. I struggled a lot because I was like, I could have, you know, closed my mouth and teach my math. But I looked at Wyoming as a whole, you know. Wyoming is a place I call home, and say, if I can, you know, I can make it a better place. All these painful events that I have to deal with, that my family have to deal with, you know, will be worth it.
Bertine Baige is still looking forward, hoping to engage and inform more Wyomingites about refugees and resettlement.
It's still hard, because every time I share it, you know, it's to a certain degree, you're kind of relieving it, and nobody want to think about the hard time that, you know, they've gone through. But I try my best to tell it, because I don't tell it for me. I don't tell it for, you know, for myself. I tell it for people to understand what is going on and educate people, because education to me is the key. The war in Congo and Rwanda have one common element, and that was lack of education. People were duped to do things that otherwise they couldn't have done if they were able to think for themselves. So if sharing my story can educate people, you know, it can help people understand, I would gladly do that, yeah.
That's Bertine Baige speaking with Caroline Ballard. For Baige, living in Wyoming as a former refugee is unusual. Even his wife, Amanda, who's from Gillette, was unfamiliar with refugees.
You know, less diverse when I was growing up than it is now. I mean, I didn't have any exposure to any of that before meeting him.
In 2013, Wyoming Governor Matt Mead looked into implementing a refugee program in the state, but the legislature didn't approve it. Caroline Ballard spoke with Scott Clem, a Republican senator from Gillette.
We're the least populated state in the union. Just a small change in the demographics here could upset the Wyoming economy, the Wyoming culture.
Clem, along with other conservative lawmakers and citizen groups, say they don't like the idea of spending money to bring foreigners to the state's small communities. Wyoming's unemployment rate is lower than the national average at around 4%. But with the recent downturn in the energy industry, Clem says people are still worried about jobs and government spending.
As it is with our decreasing revenues, we have to be careful of what we can do. We have to take care of Wyoming's own first.
That's Senator Scott Clem speaking with Caroline Ballard. Migrant workers are crucial to the state's agriculture industry. Many work on Wyoming ranches through a guest worker program called an H-2A agriculture visa. The Little Snake River Valley region of Wyoming recognizes its migrant workers by hosting an annual soccer tournament. Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Schrank has that story.
Bright neon uniforms speckle a usually empty hayfield in the sleepy town of Savory. Two soccer games are in full swing, and almost all of the players are guest workers, like Dante Bruno.
We're here to play sports today. We are Peruvians. The majority of us here are Peruvians.
38-year-old Bruno and his teammates wear pink pullovers that read Sheehan Ranch. He's been working at the ranch in bags for the past 15 years. Bruno says the work is hard, but not complicated.
This is cows, pretty much cows.
Bruno works here 9 months a year, and he earns the minimum monthly wage for the job in Wyoming.
$875, $875.
Plus room and board. Some guys on the field today make more, others less, depending on what state they live in, what work they do, and what the ranchers who hire them are willing to pay. Each of today's soccer teams is sponsored by a ranch. Savory rancher Jack Cobb started this tournament 6 years ago.
It's supposed to be a fun day just to get them out and give them a chance to socialize with each other and just play soccer.
Somebody, let's go.
Cobb says somebody the event serves to celebrate the mostly Peruvian migrant workers whose labor has been his industry's lifeblood over the past decade.
Back when I was a kid, we had, you know, American workers, and then as the oil and gas field developed, they went to higher paying jobs, and we went through the Mexican labor, and then they went looking for higher wages, and so the Peruvian, through an H-2A program, has just saved the ranching community.
But now, Cobb says the industry is in trouble again. This year, the Department of Labor proposed rules that would more than triple the $750 base wage he's required to pay his Peruvian sheep herders.
That's going to be devastating. I mean, it will be. For communities like this that are small family ranching, they're going to die.
You know, I have no problem if we need to pay these guys more, because they're worth every penny of it.
James Kelly Sewell manages the Lazy Sea Two Bar Ranch in Slater, Colorado.
There's too many of these Peruvians working at base wage. At this day and age, even $650, $750 a month is not enough money. So $1,200, $1,500, $2,000, they're worth it.
Sewell's H-2A workers earn $1,200 a month. Trade groups say the new regulations will cripple sheep ranches and grazing operations. But Sewell thinks employers can afford it. He stands on the sidelines as his ranch's team pulls out a win.
This is just a big deal for these guys. They wait for a year to play. It's quite something to take home that trophy, but it's a big day. Most of these guys will be so sore tomorrow they can hardly work, but none of us care.
Reports of abuse, fraud, and poor conditions have long plagued the country's guest worker program. A 2010 survey of sheep herders in Colorado, Wyoming, and Utah found that more than 70% lacked toilets, and half had no electricity. But spirits are high here.
But I like being cowboy. It's more easy for me.
Nario Quispe Raimundo first came to this area on a 3-year sheepherder visa. He traded up for summers doing cowboy work in Steamboat. He says he sends most of his paycheck home to his son in Lima. Beside him, a mob has gathered around a game ending in a heated shootout. Debbie and Carolyn Adams watch from the sidelines as their team, Adams Livestock, takes penalty kicks.
They're fun to come and support. Yeah. We're their cheerleaders.
Yes.
Debbie says they come and watch this tournament every year.
Most all these guys are going home. September, into September,
yeah, they're
all going
home. The fall
this is what the community does for the guys for their fun because they love it.
But there's uncertainty as to how many of these guys will be back here next year. Higher wage requirements could mean fewer visa hires. But right now, says Nicaraguan guest worker Christian Gurdian, these men are busy just enjoying the day.
It's really great because we get to get together and have fun. We're all very content and happy.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Aaron Schreck.
In 2014, author Nina McConigley won the Penn Open Book Award for her short story collection Cowboys and East Indians. Her mother is from India, her father is from Ireland. McConigley was born in Singapore, but she grew up in Wyoming. And the book explores McConigley's cross-cultural experience in the West. She joined Caroline Ballard to discuss the award.
I was on vacation with my family in France, and we were staying at this very rural country house. And so Penn actually did notify me in advance of making the official announcement, but the internet at the house was it would cut out quite a bit. And so the email, when I checked it, I could see the subject line said good news from Penn America. And I thought, but then the rest of the message wasn't there. And so I wasn't sure if I actually had won it or not. And about 6 hours later, the internet came back on and I could read the whole message. And I thought, oh my God, it was great.
But McConigley also says people oftentimes don't realize the significance of immigrants in Wyoming and the hardships they have been through to live in the state.
There are a lot of amazing Indian American and Indian authors that write about the immigrant experience. And it's a subject that I feel like sometimes people say it's being overwritten or it's a little sentimental to write about that. But I don't think many people have talked about this sort of rural immigrant experience of what it means to come into a place where there are no grocery stores, there are no restaurants, there are no places you can buy the foods that you are used to buying, and you don't see other Indians. And for me, that's a very different experience from someone who's, you know, living in Houston or San Francisco or New York, where, boy, there are other people around and there's a little bit of more of a support system. And I wanted to talk about an immigrant experience that isn't talked about a lot.
I feel like there's a lot of race relations mm-hmm. in the book.
Yeah.
So do you consider these stories to be about race?
I think for me, the stories are more about identity than race. It's about how we form our identity. And for me, obviously, I'm Indian and I look Indian, or I'm half Indian, I should say, and I look Indian. But if someone asked me about my identity, I would probably talk about Wyoming first, because this is such a place that's shaped me. And I sort of wondered and thought about, like, what is it that shapes us? Is it geography? Is it our ethnicity? Is it our race? Like, what is it? But then at the same time, my experience of growing up Indian American in Wyoming certainly isn't a common experience here. And I guess I wanted to write about, like, that part of Wyoming. And people have such a stereotype about Wyoming and the West being, you know, cowboys and the other kind of Indians. And I wanted to write about a part of Wyoming that I think a lot of people just don't realize is here, which is there are a lot of international people.
So what does winning a Penn Open Book Award mean for you?
I think it's pretty phenomenal that, it's just amazing to win. It feels really great. I kept thinking, like, when the long list came out, I thought, okay, enjoy this moment. This is great. When I made the short list, I thought, really enjoy this moment, because this is probably going to be it. So it was really fantastic to win. But I also, it's for an exceptional book by a writer of color. And I really love that it comes out of Wyoming. I just, for me, it's like, that's pretty amazing. And again, I know Wyoming, I know it's complicated here, that we aren't the most diverse state. People look at Wyoming, and I have friends who say, how can you live there? And how can you be there? And of course, my answer is, come visit me and you'll see why I live here. But I think it feels really good to say, like, this is what the state's about. It's not about a lot of people associate Wyoming with Matthew Shepard or with other things. And all of that is real, too. But I want to say it's also, it's been an amazing state for me creatively, and I want to continue to write and live here. And so winning the Penn, it just feels really good that a national sort of organization that does amazing work for writers around the world is sort of recognizing the book.
That's Nina McConaughey speaking with Caroline Ballard. She's the author of Cowboys and East Indians. And that's it for this edition of The Modern West. Catch our next episode on the third Tuesday of the month. In the meantime, you can find more stories about the Modern West at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Caitlin Tan produced the show. Anna Rader is our web editor. The theme music is by Jeff Troxell, and I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Modern West is a production of Wyoming Public Media.